nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So we'll see if we can get through here. So when most of you came in to this course, you had a basic semiconductor course, and you knew these semiconductor equations. And these are just conservation laws. There's a conservation of electric flux. There's a conservation of electrons, concentration of holes. You know, this is a balance equation. So those are what we call the basic semiconductor equations. And then we have these constitutive relations. You know, displacement is kappa times electric field. Charge density is related to the carrier densities and the doping densities. The current densities, we usually use the drift diffusion equations. So recombination, we have different ways of specifying it. So these are three equations in three unknowns: electrostatic potential, electron concentration, hole concentration. And this is the standard description of a semiconductor device that people have used for 50 years. But they can break down, and more often these days they break down, and that was the purpose of the whole course, to try to learn a little bit more. You know, first questions had to do with, where does this equation come from? How do you derive a drift diffusion equation? And how are some of these parameters related to the properties of the material? So if you're dealing with a new material like graphene, how would you compute the mobility and diffusion coefficient? If you're looking for materials with certain types of high mobility, or, you know, what would you look for? But then we wanted to understand, what are the assumptions when we derive that equation, and what do we miss? What happens when the drift diffusion breaks down? And then what do we do when it breaks down? You know, so we want to be able to recognize when it might not be good enough to solve the problem, and we'd like to have some understanding of what techniques we might use to solve the problem. And we started the first 5 weeks of the course with this bottom-up approach. So we said, let's take something really small and understand its conductance, and then see if we can understand bigger devices based on that. And you know, you could think of it as a small molecule with a couple of contacts. You know, people, 10 or 15 years ago now, people started doing experiments and understanding IV characteristics of molecules, and then you had to understand current flow and very small structures. But the channel of a MOSFET these days is a very small structure. So it's important to understand how to treat the IV characteristics of very small structures, but then to relate it to bigger structures. And the model that we did, we derived this thing called the Landauer model. And this is a very good starting point, much better than a drift diffusion equation. If I were teaching 606, I think this is the way I would start, not with a drift diffusion equation. Because it's just as simple. You can derive a drift diffusion equation from it, but you can treat problems like quantized conductance that you couldn't treat with a drift diffusion equation. So the main idea was that current flows whenever you have a difference in Fermi level between the two contacts. There are a couple of key physical parameters. One is the number of conducting channels, which we think of as the number of half wavelengths that fit into the width of the resistor if it's a 2D, number of subbands if it's a nanowire. Then we have the transmission, which is just a number between 0 and 1. It tells us how much current transmits from the left to the right or from the right to the left. We had to make a number of simplifying assumptions that are not always obeyed in practice, but they're frequently close enough. And we have these ideal contacts that just absorb carriers. They don't reflect them. And there's no inelastic scattering within the device, only in the contacts. So we made that separation. That's what allows us to have a transmission from right to left that's equal to the transmission from left to right. Okay, so we took that equation, which if you looked at my lecture on nanotransistors, you can apply to a ballistic nanotransistor. But the first part of the course, we looked at small biases. So we said, well, if we just have a small voltage difference between the two contacts, then we have a small difference between F1 and F2. And when it's small, we can do a Taylor series expansion of F1 minus F2. And what we find is that F1 minus F2 is proportional to the voltage difference across the device. And that means current is proportional to voltage, or we can define a conductance. And we get this simple expression for conductance, you know, in terms of fundamental parameters that are about 1 over 12.7 kiloohms. Okay. So the easiest thing for us to work with then in applying this device was to think about a ballistic resistor where the transmission is one. Everything that comes in the left goes out the right, or vice versa. And then we can also make things easier by going to low temperature or strongly degenerate system. The Fermi level makes this transition from 1 to 0. So the derivative, you know, it makes the transition from 1 to 0 right around the Fermi energy. So this derivative is only important around the Fermi energy. And when you're strongly degenerate or the temperature is low, that's just a delta function, which makes it easy to do that integral. And we get this fundamental expression that conductance is the quantum of conductance times the number of channels. This is, you know, very general. You know, people have measured the conductance of a hydrogen molecule or small molecules or quantum point contacts. These are the answers you get. What a lot of people still won't appreciate is that this applies to big devices too. A lot of people think about this Landauer approach as something that you only use for very small devices, but we saw we can use it for small devices or large devices or anything in between. Now, more generally, when we're at finite temperatures, we have to do that integral. The only place that this derivative is important is right around the Fermi energy, a few kT around that. So it means that it's going to be an effective number of channels within that Fermi window, where this derivative is positive, right? So that's the way we can think about that. Now then, so in order to do anything and actually make a calculation, we have to understand M, the number of modes. So we spent some time talking about density of states, which we're all familiar with before we come in, but also this distribution of modes, this M of E. So we need two different things. We need a density of states. That's what we use to get the carrier densities. If we know the Fermi level and we want to get the carrier density, we integrate density of states times Fermi function over energy. But if we want current, we need this distribution of modes. We need these two separate things. Now, classically, you know, people would say if you want to solve carrier densities and current densities, you use a density of states effective mass for carrier density and use a conductivity effective mass for current. It's the same thing, just a different language. So to determine that N of E, you know, if we have a nano wire, we just count how many subbands are occupied because there are only a few. If we've got a 2D resistor with some width W, if it's very narrow, we can just count the number of half wavelengths that are there. If it's wider, you know, then we find that it's just proportional to the width. And if it's 3D and it's wide, the number of channels at a particular energy is just proportional to the cross-sectional area. And we developed expressions for all of those. Okay. So when we came into this class, we knew the expressions for the density of states. And we, you know, we understand how they vary with energy in 1D, 2D, and 3D. So, you know, people use these kind of qualitative pictures to figure out what's going to happen with a nanowire differently than what happens in a bulk. But then we learned how to calculate these modes in 1D, 2D, and 3D, and they have different energy dependencies than the densities of states. But this is what's important for current flow. Okay. And we talked just a little bit. There's a general definition. And it's a little hard to see in looking at this definition that this is the number of half wavelengths that fit into the width or cross section, but that's what it is. But it's proportional to the average velocity at energy E in the direction of current flow times the density of states at that energy. So if we have any material, we can deduce the number of channels through this prescription. So if we have a very complicated band structure, we can always figure out what the distribution of modes is. All right. So we started with ballistic because it's easy, but diffusive, we have a transmission that we have to work on. And at first, we just presented the result that the transmission is mean-free path over mean-free path plus length. Later on, we derived that. And it actually, it works very well in many cases. So the only change is that instead of an M, we have an M times a transmission, just some number between 0 and 1. And when the mean-free path is much bigger than the length of the resistor, the transmission is about 1, and we get back the ballistic result. When the mean-free path is much less than the length of the resistor, then the transmission is about mean-free path divided by length, and we get this diffusive result, but we can go anywhere in between. Okay. So this explains why, you know, we know that in 3D, for example, the current is proportional, or the conductance is proportional to area divided by length. It's proportional to area because the number of channels is proportional to the cross-sectional area. It's inversely proportional to length because the transmission is inversely proportional to length. So that's the way we think about that. Now, one of the things that that I tried to make that I hope you will take with you is that you very frequently, device people want to talk about a mobility. Okay. Now, more fundamentally, what we can compute for any material is the conductance, right? This is easy to compute. Now, if I want to talk about a mobility, I just equate the conductance to conductivity, NQ mu. If I want conductance, I should have had an A over L here, right? Then I'll get conductance. If I just equate the two and solve it for mobility, that's the way to get mobility. Right? If you encounter a strange new material, you know, you might be tempted to get the mobility with some simpler formula you used in your first courses, but you can quickly get confused with that. You know, this is the way to start. Now, we showed that under certain conditions, like if you're low temperature, you just work this out and you'll find that the mobility is Q tau over M. Tau at the Fermi energy, effective mass. You know, if you do it for graphene, it's not clear what effective mass to use. You know, if you think about it a little bit and work on it, you can find an appropriate definition for it. But it's much better just to do it this way. It's clear how to get the number of modes for graphene. It's clear how to get the transmission. You just work this out, find out what the mobility is. If you want to put it into this familiar form, you can later. But starting with this form frequently gets you confused. Now, that's the fully degenerate form. You know, the non-degenerate form, we found that we do this kind of thing for a non-degenerate semiconductor. Mobility is diffusion coefficient divided by KT over Q, right? That looks familiar, gives us a nice warm feeling. We learned that diffusion coefficient is thermal velocity times average mean free path divided by 2, where this is average Vx plus that I showed earlier. This is the average velocity in the direction of transport near equilibrium. Okay. And, you know, then we tried to relate all of this back to the drift diffusion equation. Because when everyone came into this course, everyone knew the drift diffusion equation. And that was relatively easy to do. We took our Landauer expression. We took the transmission in the diffusive limit, because the drift diffusion equation describes diffusive transport. We said that what the voltage does here is it gives us a difference in quasi-Fermi level if we're thinking about conventional transport. And it just took a little bit of algebra to show that this expression is just conductivity times gradient of the quasi-Fermi potential in volts. And we have a simple prescription for the conductivity. This is a very fundamental starting point for a lot of near equilibrium transport. You'll see books on thermodynamics, non-equilibrium thermodynamics that will derive this expression. You know, this is a very general expression for current flow in any material, but we know how to relate it now to material parameters and things. And you can easily show from this expression, this derivative is taken at a constant temperature, you can easily show that it gives you the drift diffusion equation. Sometimes in some beginning semiconductor books, you start here and show that it gives you this. That's really the wrong way. This is fundamental, right? You can show that it gives you the drift diffusion equation. Okay, so then we talked a little more. So far, you know, at first we just assumed that the only thing giving us a difference between F1 and F2 was the voltage difference between the two contacts. But if there's a temperature difference between the two contacts, we can have a difference between F1 and F2. And we just did a little Taylor series expansion, and now we had the term that gave us conductance, but now we have another term. So we get current flow whenever there's a difference in voltage or a difference in temperature, and that led to these coupled current equations, which we could write for, you know, a device with two contacts with some finite length. So we could write it in terms of, like, conductance, electrical conductance, thermal conductance, thing we call the Soré coefficient. Or we could invert those and solve for delta V and just define a different set of parameters. Here I have resistance, 1 over conductance. Here I have Seebeck coefficient. Here I have Peltier coefficient. All right. And we showed how we can get all of those from the Landauer expressions easily. The conductance, what we do is we just add up the contributions from every channel. And every channel has a differential conductance that's given by the expression that we saw earlier. And then the other parameters also are relatively easy to work out. And, you know, and they are all some moment of this differential conductance. Depending on what the parameter is, we have different moments. Okay. And we could do this for diffusive transport. So then we just let the sample get long. Transmission is lambda over L. Then we get the conventional expressions that you get for bulk thermoelectric transport, current and electronic flow. All right. So these are the standard thermoelectric equations. You see them written all kinds of different ways, but, you know, they're all equivalent to the same thing. Now, we tried to discuss the physics, like of where the Peltier effect comes from and where the Seebeck coefficient comes from, because it's easy to get to just think of that as a bunch of mathematics. And the Peltier effect, for example, it was easy to see what was going on. We have our two contacts. You know, electrons from the first contact, in order to get in up to the conduction band where they can flow across and come out the other contact, you know, the current is flowing near the Fermi level in a metal because that's where minus DFDE is positive or finite. But so the electrons that flow in near the Fermi level have to absorb heat and get up to the bottom of the conduction band where they can flow across the conductor. And then they come out and they dissipate their heat in the second contact. They go out that contact, flow around the external circuit. They come in at the Fermi energy. And you just repeat all of that. So one contact gets cool, the one with the blue arrow. One contact gets hot. If you switch the direction of current flow, you just switch the red and the blue. And, you know, that's the Peltier effect. We went through an argument for the Seebeck coefficient physically, so we could see where it comes from, you know, and before we derived those equations. Okay. So that's a thermoelectric effect. So we can write those equations, you know, in different ways. We can write the conductivity as 2q squared over h. You know, this is writing that integral expression just in a way that to make it look more familiar. Quantum of conductance times number of channels in the Fermi window times average mean free path. And you know, we specified exactly what that average was. The Seebeck coefficient is related to some fundamental constants. But then it's the average energy at which current flows with respect to the Fermi energy. So the higher that energy is, the bigger the Seebeck coefficient. And then the Peltier coefficient is related to the Seebeck coefficient. And the electrons carry charge and electrons carry heat. So we expect that the thermal conductivity for electrons will be proportional to the electrical conductivity for electrons. We find all of that. Now that last one, this Lorentz number, this is a numerical factor, I think, times Boltzmann's constant divided by Q squared. Okay. And you often see it written as that numerical factor 2 for a non-degenerate semiconductor and pi squared over 3. So this is what you get if you derive it for a parabolic semiconductor in the non-degenerate limit and in the fully degenerate limit. Okay. But the real number depends on details of band structure and scattering, whether you're 1D or 2D or 3D. You know. So sometimes, you know, people have the feeling that this is a law of nature and that these numbers, pi squared over 3, are like fundamental laws. They aren't. You know, this is just a rule of thumb. It's not a law of nature. But this is not a rule of thumb. You know, this has to be exact. That's the Kelvin relation. Okay, so we talked a little bit about thermoelectric devices and that we can use them either to run current through them and make one side hot and one side cold, or we can apply heat to the top and have the bottom cooler and we can generate an electrical current. In either case, the efficiency is determined by this dimensionless figure of merit. This is what everyone who works on thermoelectrics works on and tries to improve. And the fundamental challenge is that as you increase the Fermi level, the Seebeck coefficient decreases. And you should be able to explain physically why that happens, right? Not just from the equations. Now, as you increase the Fermi level, the conductivity increases because, you know, you should be able to explain that physically too in words. So if I increase the Fermi energy, sigma increases, but S squared decreases. So there's some optimum. And that's what people try to do in thermoelectric design, is to figure out how you optimize that numerator. This is like a big research question. This seems pretty fundamental. There's this trade-off. Right? Is there any way to engineer a structure that this wouldn't happen, or that this would happen in a different way, that you could improve the product of S squared sigma? This is what a lot of people are thinking about a lot, because if you could do that, you could improve the performance of a thermoelectric device. Okay, so that was like the first 5 weeks or so. So we did all of the standard things that you could pick up a book from the 1950s or 60s, and we have all the results that are in those books, most of them. We also have ballistic results that weren't in any of those books, probably until the 90s, right? But there's another way that we could treat the same problem, and that's with the Boltzmann transport equation. So we could treat the same near equilibrium transport problems, but it's also a convenient way to treat problems that are very far from equilibrium, but in the bulk where there are no transients or in steady state, no transients in space or time. And we can also treat what we call non-local transport, where things vary rapidly in space and maybe time. So the Boltzmann transport equation is something that we want to know. Even though when we apply it to near equilibrium transport, we're going to get all the same answers. And the basic idea is you follow the electrons through their equations of motion in K space and position space, and they have equations of motion that look like, almost like Newton's law. Right. Just modified a little bit with the effect of mass. And then we learned how to write the Boltzmann equation. So this is one of the Landauer formula is one of the big ideas you want to remember for 25 years. The Boltzmann equation is another one. So the first part describes the flow of electrons in this position wave vector phase space. The right-hand side describes the effect of collisions, and that involves probabilities that states are occupied or empty times a probability that you'll make a transition by scattering from one state to another state. Okay. So we talked about solving that equation. In equilibrium, we could just detailed balance says that every scattering event is canceled by exactly the opposite scattering event, so there's no net effect. And that might sound like a trivial problem, but we showed that you can solve the Boltzmann equation, and then you can prove that the Fermi level is constant and the temperature is constant in equilibrium. Something, you know, that you may have assumed in your first semiconductor course, but it follows directly from the Boltzmann equation. Now, the other way to make the right-hand side zero is to say we're very far from equilibrium, but there is no scattering. That's ballistic transport. And in ballistic transport, we learned that inside the device, there are two kinds of states. Some states that can be filled by the first contact, according to the Fermi level of the first contact, and some states that can be filled by the second contact, according to the Fermi level in the second contact. So, states are either in equilibrium with one contact or with the other contact. But overall, you're very far from equilibrium. So we could solve it. It was relatively easy. If I have contact 1 with a Fermi level 1 and contact 2 with a Fermi level 2, and I want to know how the states are filled at some location inside the device, you know, I can see that if electrons come in from contact 1, they can only fill these states above the top of the barrier. So those red states, that's the fraction of the states that can be filled by contact 1. If electrons come in with negative velocities, they can fill all the negative velocity states. But if they come in with an energy below the top of the barrier, they can reflect off and become positive velocities and fill up those states. So wherever I go in this device, I can always divide the states into two pieces. I really don't want to talk about a Fermi level inside the device under ballistic conditions. I know what the Fermi level is in contact 2, and I know what it is in contact 1. I've got two different Fermi levels inside the device. You know, you can kind of roughly, qualitatively, you might take the average, or you might figure out a way to weight it with position. You might get something that looks like a quasi-Fermi level. But a quasi-Fermi level is really something that is better defined in diffusive cases where there's lots of scattering. In this ballistic case, it's not a good way to think about the problem. Right. Okay, so the next thing we did was we said, can we solve this with small applied biases like we did in the first 5 weeks by Landauer? And to do that, we introduced this relaxation time approximation. We saw that it's a reasonable way to describe the effects of scattering very simply, and we even showed that it's exact under certain conditions. We went ahead and solved the Boltzmann equation, and we found that it's the equilibrium value plus something that is proportional to the electric field, which tells you how far from equilibrium you are. So if that dashed line is the equilibrium solution, then if you apply an electric field, you can think of it as putting a force in the minus x direction on all the electrons, so it's going to push everything to the minus. And the solution is basically a, we call it a displaced Maxwellian. It just pushes the peak in a little direction. So we could work out everything. We get all of the conductivity, the Peltier coefficient, the Seebeck coefficient, the electronic thermal conductivity. Everything is the same as we got before. Right. Okay. So we, you know, you might ask, you know, why do I need to know both techniques? I think you really do need to know both techniques. Now, one is, when you think about a BTE, it really requires an EK, right? We derived an equation of motion in K space. So it requires that you have a material with a band structure. You can treat ballistic transport with the Boltzmann equation. Mathematically, it gets a bit messy. You have to be very careful about how you apply boundary conditions to this and just specify incoming fluxes. In the diffusive case, in the bulk, it works out nicely and easily. You get all the answers that we got before. One big advantage is you can put B fields in, and you can easily add the effect of B fields. You can treat anisotropic transport very nicely, so you can get, we see that all of those, the conductivity, the Seebeck coefficient, they're all tensors. And if you have an anisotropic material, you can easily work those out. But a lot of times when you're doing this, you know, you get the feeling that you're just doing mathematics. And you get expressions that are right, but sometimes it's hard to see what the terms mean. Now, Landauer, we've been assuming an EK in this course. One of the nice things about this Landauer approach is it doesn't really need an EK. All right, we could do everything without that if we knew the electronic structure. So if it's an amorphous material, if it's a molecule with a set of energy levels, there's no band structure. But you can still use the Landauer approach. It's relatively easy to treat ballistic transport, almost trivial, whereas in the Boltzmann it's much more difficult, and we can go anywhere in between. And usually it's much easier to see what the terms in the equation mean and where they come from. Right. So it's good to know both of them. So we went ahead and we put the B field in, and we showed, for example, that the conductivity, which when we assume an isotropic material was just a number without a B field, now becomes a tensor. So for 2D transport, it becomes a 2x2 matrix. And the Seebeck coefficient and the electronic conductivity and everything else becomes a tensor. It looks something like this. And we went ahead and, you know, showed how you can also write this as a drift diffusion equation, where you've got a product of E cross B, and this obviously comes from the Lorentz force that's deflecting the electrons. So this is widely used for things like Hall effect measurements, you know, when we want to characterize semiconducting devices. Okay, so that brought us to the point where we thought we should understand a little more about where this equation comes from. So we talked about how you derive this equation. And then the mean free path itself is something that depends on the details of scattering. So we had to talk about that as well. And that also brought us back, you know, this is what we needed for the Landauer. In the Boltzmann, we need this collision integral if we can't use the relaxation time approximation. So we needed to learn how we calculate this transition from one state to another. So all of these have to do with the details of the scattering processes. So we talked about the physics of scattering, and the idea is that after a certain time, all the carriers have scattered on average. That's the scattering rate. After a longer time in general, all of the momentum has been relaxed, so there's no current. And after an even longer time in general, all of the energy is relaxed, and now they're in equilibrium with the lattice. So those characteristic times are things that we can compute if we know how this fundamental transition from an electron from one P to another P, if we know the probability of every one of those transitions. And we get those from Fermi's golden rule. So scattering in quantum mechanics can get complicated, but the simplest way to treat it is this Fermi's golden rule, and this is by far the most common way to do it for semiconducting problems. Every now and then, people will say, well, it's the first order approximation. Every now and then, it isn't good enough, and people will go beyond it. But it's usually the starting point, and it's where most of the expressions that you get for scattering rates and mobilities come from Fermi's golden rule. And one of the things we learned in solving that is that the scattering rate is proportional to the density of final states generally. And, you know, that's very intuitive. If there are many states that an electron can scatter to, then it's going to have a higher probability of scattering somewhere. Right. So the scattering rate versus energy generally looks like the density of states versus energy, or similar. Okay, there are lots of different scattering mechanisms that are possible, and we didn't go through all of these in detail, but I do in the book. You know, you can have various types of defects. You can scatter, the carriers can scatter from themselves, and the carriers can scatter from phonons. And these are all coupled, because the carriers can screen charged impurities. And phonons, especially the ones in polar materials, have electric fields, and they can be screened by carriers too. So these can all get coupled together in ways that can lead to some interesting effects and make scattering a bit complicated to treat. Okay, so then we could return. back to solving for transport, and now we could start to think about what do we do when the bias is high and we're very far from equilibrium. So the Boltzmann equation gives us a nice way to do that. Okay. And there are various ways to solve the Boltzmann equation. So one way to solve the Boltzmann equation is to take moments of the Boltzmann equation. So you take the F, assume you know F, you weight it by some function of momentum, and if you choose the function properly, you can get any physical quantity that you're interested in. Carrier density, current density, heat flux, temperature, whatever it is you're looking for. And we saw that if we multiply the Boltzmann equation by this function and sum over all the states, we're basically integrating momentum out of the problem. Okay, now these quantities only depend on position and time. We integrate out momentum. We say we don't want that fine-grained. All we want to know is how the quantity varies in space and time. Then we get this continuity equation that any physical quantity has to obey. And, you know, we developed a prescription. So if you want to generate one of those continuity equations for any physical quantity, you can generate it. And one example was going back to the drift diffusion equation again. If we want to generate a current equation, the quantity that we would multiply by would be the minus Q times the velocity. So for a parabolic band semiconductor, that would be momentum divided by mass. And then the quantity that we would be getting would be the electron current along direction I, X, Y, or Z. And we just went through our prescription from the Boltzmann equation, and this is what the proper current equation should look like. It's not a drift diffusion equation yet. And so far there are no approximations there. It's as accurate as the Boltzmann equation. Okay. But to use it in practice, you know, we don't know what the average scattering time is because we have to compute that average over the distribution, which we don't know since we haven't solved the Boltzmann equation. And this quantity W is like a kinetic energy, but it can have off-diagonal components. And we know in equilibrium it's just 3/2 kT and 1/2 kT along each direction and no off-diagonal components. But out of equilibrium, it could be very complicated. So in practice, we usually simplify it. So if I assume that things are varying slowly on the scale of a momentum relaxation time, which is like tenths of picoseconds. So it's like tenths of picoseconds. So this is like terahertz frequencies or something. As long as you're varying slowly on that scale, we can ignore the time derivative. Well, very high frequency problems, people will retain this. But most of the problems, we can ignore that. And then if I assume that this tensor is diagonal, I can just take one component of it. And I get something that looks like a drift diffusion equation now. Drift term, diffusion term, but carrier density times the kinetic energy associated with movement in the x direction. Px times Vx divided by 2. So that's my drift diffusion equation. And, you know, near equilibrium, this is 1/2 kt, and I get my normal drift diffusion equation. But out of equilibrium, it works as well. Okay. The other way to solve the Boltzmann equation is by Monte Carlo simulation, where you just take a million electrons or something, and you just track them through the semiconductor by following their equations of motion. Let them move, and then let them scatter, and let them move under the influence of the electric field, and just keep doing that long enough until everything settles down, take averages, and you can show that that's a solution of the Boltzmann equation. So the process consists of free flight. It travels ballistically for some t/c seconds, and then we just update its position and energy. Then it scatters with something. We choose a random number to figure out what did it scatter from. It goes off in some direction. It might have gained or lost energy depending on whether it's an elastic or inelastic process. And it's now pointing in a different direction in general, so we update the energy and momentum. And now we have an electron, we just start over again and we repeat it. So it's simple conceptually. And if you choose the random numbers so that they're consistent with the physics of the scattering in the problem, then you're just mimicking the physical processes directly. Okay. So it's kind of a hybrid. The free flight part of it, we take these semi-classical equations of motion. It looks like the electron is a particle obeying laws that look like Newton's laws, just modified by the band structure. But the scattering processes we treat quantum mechanically by Fermi's golden rule. Right. Okay, so, we could use either the balance equation approach or the Monte Carlo approach then to look at carrier transport on bulk semiconductors under high electric fields and things like these velocity field characteristics. And in general, the idea is that you input power from the electric field, that causes the energy to increase. Okay. If the energy increases, then in general there are more states to scatter to because you're at higher energies. Density of states usually increase with energy, so the scattering time drops, and that explains why when your electric field gets high enough and the scattering time drops, then the velocity saturates in silicon. In gallium arsenide, it's a little more complicated because the same things are happening, but you're transferring from a valley with a light effective mass to a valley with a high effective mass, and you get that negative differential conductivity. Okay. Now, these problems lead to a field-dependent mobility, but the concept of a field-dependent mobility applies only when the electric field varies slowly with position or doesn't vary at all. If you have a very rapid change in electric field, then you'd expect something like this. Where the field is constant or varying slowly, you would just expect that the mobility would be the mobility due to that field. Way out here, if I've got a lower electric field, I'd have a higher mobility in general because I'd have the mobility associated with this field. But in here, it gets complicated because there's no one-to-one relation between the distribution function F, which is what matters, right, and the electric field, because the electric field is changing rapidly on the scale of a momentum and energy relaxation rate. So the only way really to find out what happens when the electric field is varying rapidly is to solve the Boltzmann equation. And this is where you get velocity overshoot. So here's a low electric field in silicon. Here's a high electric field in silicon. Here's a low electric field in silicon. You can see that the dashed line here is the energy. It's just electrons come in with 3/2 kT in the low field region. They get accelerated. They go up to a much higher energy, 10 times higher in the high field region. And then they come down and they go back down. All right. Just nothing. Nothing very unusual happens. But because of this difference in the energy and momentum relaxation times, in the velocity, some very unusual things happen. If I wait long enough in the high field region, the velocity is just the saturated velocity of electrons in silicon, 10 to the 7th. But there's this transient that occurs because the momentum and energy relaxation times are different. And in that period, I can have a high field and a mobility that is still relatively high because the carriers haven't gained enough energy from the electric field yet. And that gives me this velocity overshoot. The spatial extent here you can see is roughly a tenth of a micron. How long is a tenth of a micron in nanometers? 100 nanometers. Channel lengths in MOSFETs these days are 30 nanometers. Small transistors these days, typical transistors these days, are operating in this regime where very strong non-local transport, right? Velocity overshoot. Okay, so that's what happens in small devices. This is velocity overshoot. That's typically what's occurring in a small device these days. Then we went back a little bit and talked about ballistic and diffusive transport. And, you know, say we have a thin region like the base of a bipolar transistor, and we're injecting some flux of electrons from the emitter into the base. What comes out is just the transmission across the base times what was injected in. Okay. Now, if the transmission is 1, then what comes in goes out. And I could always write this flux, what comes in, as the number that come in times the thermal velocity. Let's say they're injected at the thermal velocity. Okay. So under that condition, if the thermal velocity is constant across the entire slab, if I have no electric field, so it's like the base, right? They're not being accelerated. Their velocity is the thermal velocity. Then N is constant. So in the ballistic base, the carrier density would just be constant like that. If I solve Fick's law, then I have diffusive transport. And the diffusive transport, you know, the flux then is given by carriers down the concentration gradient. And all of this just comes out naturally if I take T as lambda over lambda plus L. And in the ballistic limit, I get it constant. In the diffusive limit, I get the Fick's law. And, you know, if I'm quasi-ballistic, then I have some finite carrier density here, and the slope has just changed. Okay. Okay, so we've talked about these three main ways to solve for transport. We've really only emphasized two. You know, one is Landauer, which is always a good way to think about devices when you're near equilibrium and if you're far from equilibrium but you're ballistic. Then it's a good way to solve the problem. We also have the Boltzmann equation, which also works near equilibrium. It's a little harder, much harder actually, to treat ballistic transport with it, although, you know, you see people doing it. It also works far from equilibrium, although the easiest place to use it far from equilibrium is when you're diffusive, right? So depending on the problem, you'd pick one or the other. Also works nicely for B fields. Now, quantum transport was really not the focus of the course, but I thought, you know, you should know something about that. You know, and that's what happens when the semi-classical picture breaks down. When, you know, if you look, you have this uncertainty relation, delta P, delta X is greater than H bar. If you need to localize, you know, if you need to localize the electron too small, then we have this uncertainty relation. If that comes in, then we can't use a semi-classical picture. The semi-classical picture assumes we can specify position and momentum. In principle, you can't do that. The other way to think about when quantum transport is important is when the electrostatic potential changes significantly on the scale of the electron wavelength, then you're going to have reflections or tunneling. Right? And then, you know, you have techniques like NEGF. So here's the density of states inside the device when you treat it by a quantum approach, not a classical approach. And you can see all kinds of interferences and interesting effects. And these are becoming important. I guess in Professor Dada, any of you taken 495 by Professor Dada? Does he talk about NEGF in 495?
Just mentions.
Right. So it's 659 if you the focus on 659 would be on quantum transport. Okay, so I just want to mention that although the drift diffusion equation, you know, has a lot of limitations, and we've learned about them in this course, it's still very useful for a large number of cases. You know, if you're working on solar cells, you probably want to use a drift diffusion equation. But what we've learned in 656 is what determines the mobility and diffusion coefficient. And maybe if you think about that, you can start thinking about ways that you could engineer the mobility and diffusion coefficient. But we've learned about the assumptions it takes to derive that equation and what happens when those assumptions break down, things like velocity overshoot. And we've discussed what some of those effects are. And then we spent a lot of time on, you know, techniques that go beyond these things we call the semiconductor equations. Landauer, Boltzmann, and just briefly on quantum transport. Oops, I got a typo here. So you haven't learned everything about transport, but you should have learned enough that you can figure out any problem you encounter in your career, right? Because, you know, for the rest of your career, you won't have the luxury of taking a course every time you encounter a new problem, right? You'll have a problem, you'll have to figure out, you'll have to learn what you need to learn in order to solve the problem. Hopefully you have enough basic understanding that you know how to get started. There's probably one major topic in transport that we've left out, and that's percolation. So in random or disordered materials, you know, that's a different type of transport that is very important for a certain class of materials. We've only talked about things like extended states and band structures where carriers flow freely. When you have materials where electrons hop from one site to another and undergo a random process where they actually move, that's a percolation problem. And that's a class of problems that you should know something about. Professor Alam has one or two lectures on the NanoHub. It's a good place to start for that. If I could figure out how to put all of that into 656, maybe I can if we cut down on some of the other things. That's probably the one major type of transport that you should try to get familiar with that we haven't talked about.